morning, Atlanta. It is July 31st. I'm Dana Barrett, and I'm very excited about today's show. It's kind of a spiritual, mystical, magical group that I have here today. So around the room right now, I have David Papa, a transformational innovation consultant and coach. Welcome.
Hello.
Hello. Jennifer Schwartz, gallery owner, crusader for art, all around awesomeness. How are you?
I'm great, thanks.
And author Jeffrey Small, Jericho Deception. Welcome.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So I usually start out with headlines. I'm not going to do that today because we have such an interesting group and I really want to get into talking to these guys. But first, I have to tell you guys a story. I lost my keys this morning. Have you ever lost your keys? I mean, not just for a minute, but for like 10 minutes where you're running around the house. And my house isn't that big, you know, running around the house, looking under every rock, under every piece of furniture, moving things, looking in drawers that you know there's no possible way you ever put the keys in that drawer.
You're just sweating.
Sweating. You're watching the time tick by. And can I say, why do you open that drawer that you know there's no way I put the keys in
you
the junk drawer
twice
in the kitchen?
Already.
Right.
Too.
Right.
It's because one time you found them in the refrigerator somewhere really weird. And so you have to
leave
make
sure.
No stone unturned.
Yes. So meanwhile, in the midst of this frenzy, literally, I'm watching the clock go by thinking, how am I going to let these three people know that I can't do the show because I can't leave my house? And so I called my boyfriend and I said, oh my God, I lost the keys. And he was like, and you want me to do what? He's at work. He's like, and I should help you how? Well, it turns out I actually did leave my keys in his car. Ooh. So at least I wasn't completely crazy. They weren't there in the house, but luckily I found a spare. So here I am.
I was going to say, the lesson would be
keep a spare. Yes.
Keep a spare in the fridge.
So I'm glad to be here, but I'm a little frazzled. And so I'm especially glad to be here with you guys because I feel like this is like the most calm, like spiritually in tune, like relaxed group that I maybe have ever had in here. So
what are you talking hopefully
about?
We'll be interesting.
Seriously. Yeah. It's a lot of pressure.
I know. No pressure. Well, because Business Radio X, you know, a lot, because it's business radio, we often have these like high powered executives who have probably more agita and anxiety than I can even imagine on a daily basis. Not you guys. You're all, you know, in touch with your feelings and artists and, you know, I love it. It's all good. So,
or we have much less power.
Yeah, but that is a good point, I think. I was just reading something the other day about that, that power actually, I think it was in Daniel Pink's newest book, where he was talking about, I think he said something about power. Actually, statistics show that the more power you have, the less you are in tune with others, the less attunement you can achieve.
Hmm.
So if you are high up in an organization, you have to make an extra effort to step back and listen and try to be attuned with others because literally it's not in your makeup.
I can see that. I can see that, especially because when you get higher up, you're also seen in a different way. You're not seen as a listener as much as you are as, you know, the one giving the orders.
Yeah.
So you get reinforced every time you don't listen and every time you make a decision and sort of direct the flow. In a lot of organizations, it doesn't reinforce the idea of making sure you're in tune with those around you.
Yeah.
Do you think it means that the people that are in these leadership positions are sort of missing that element of their personality? Or do you think that people get higher up by not listening to other people, by not considering so many other people's feelings, and you know, they just kind of are singularly focused on themselves?
Yeah, I think being a highly empathetic person can almost make it more difficult to be a strong leader, a strong CEO when, you know, the economy's struggling and you've got to make tough decisions and, you know, cut staff. I think being really in tune with people can almost make it more challenging versus someone who's just cutthroat and looking to, you know, only at the bottom line. And
yeah.
How do we get ahead? How do we, you know, get it to the next level and not as, you know, much in tune with what's going on with the people?
Yeah, I think it may be a combination of both. I think everyone is capable of being in tune with others. But I think to David's point, I think sort of as you climb the ladder, you start to shut that off more and more. Because of the reinforcement you're getting and because you think people expect you to behave a certain way. It's kind of interesting because the book that I'm reading, the Dan Pink book, it's talking about how to sell and or how to move others is how he says it. It's not necessarily about selling anymore. It's just about convincing people to do something, whether there's a transaction or not. And in order to actually move others, you have to be in tune with them. You have to know what they want, what they need, what they care about, or you will never move them. And I'm sure this is going to be the most beautiful segue of all time. I'm sure you can appreciate that, Jennifer, because you're trying to move people to art.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, but I've also heard the other side that a lot of successful gallery owners, especially female gallery owners, can be pretty intense and not the warmest of people. And I've had some people give me advice, you know, if you want to be successful in this field, you need to be a pit bull. You need to, you know, get out there and I have said I'm not interested in doing that. I mean, if I can't be successful by and still be true to myself, then I'm not interested in that type of
your definition of success.
Exactly.
I'm only interested.
Exactly.
Right. And the thing is, I think you're spot on because I think the economy is changing. And when I say economy, I don't just mean the numbers. I think the business world we live in is changing. And David and I will definitely get to that when we get to what he's working on. But I think most people are looking for more meaning in what they do.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there are a lot of old school people still around who will tell you that you have to fit into a mold and be a certain thing. I don't agree. So that's why I'm so happy to have all three of you here. But Jennifer, I want to focus a little bit on you. So for the listeners who didn't catch our interview last year, explain a little bit about what you do.
Sure. Well, I own a photography gallery in Atlanta, the Jennifer Schwartz Gallery, and we promote and sell and try to give exposure to emerging photographers. So photographers who are just starting to make a name for themselves. And what I realized early on was that when you are showing the work of artists who aren't proven yet in the market, a huge part of my job and a big challenge is to create an audience for these people because they don't already have one. And so in kind of going through that and really trying to figure out who is this target audience and how do you attract someone who might not be already exploring art in their world? How do you bring them in and what types of programs can you do and how can you facilitate an opportunity for a person to make a really personal connection with the artist, with the art? And so that has inspired the Crusade for Art, this mission-based organization where I'm really advocating for that, for creating demand for art and for cultivating new audiences for art. And so I one specific project, a special project that I did through the Crusade for Art was this Crusade for Collecting tour. And what I had realized in my gallery in Atlanta was that the most successful programs to engage new people really involved having them meet the artist, be able to have a personal one-to-one experience where they can hear about the work, hear about the individual piece, and really really recognize that there can be a layered depth of meaning there. And so I have done and continue to do a lot of programs locally, but I also felt that if my mission was to really reach new people, then people that weren't already seeking an arts experience, then sitting in my gallery in Atlanta trying to lure people in wasn't maybe the best way or the only way. And so I decided I would take it on the road and bring art to the people. So
I love it.
So
it's like, instead of a food truck, it's
exactly
like...
It was a 1977 Volkswagen bus, Lady Blue. Adorable, not reliable, but adorable.
Nice.
Looks really good on the sweatshirt.
Nice.
So went to 10 different cities around the country and I curated five photographers from each city to participate. So the idea was we did stop in a high foot traffic area in the center of town, and the five photographers were there with 10 copies, small prints that were signed. So a single image, 10 copies. And as people were walking by, we were trying to engage them with the project. And these are five local artists. They're all, they each have 10 copies of an image to give away. You can ask each of them about the piece and make a selection based on the one that you feel the most connected to. And it usually took about 2 hours to give away 50 pieces. Definitely a lot harder in some cities than others. Giving away free things is
amazing.
really, yeah, a lot more challenging than you might think.
Did people just not trust you? Like, why didn't they want it?
A lot of not trusting.
They're like, what's the catch?
Yeah, and it really had to do with kind of where we were, the personality of the city. I mean, LA, I had done two test runs, I guess, in Atlanta and in New Orleans at the end of last year. And the first city on the consecutive tour was LA, and it was this beautiful sunny day in Abbot Kinney, which is this kind of trendy retail area of Venice Beach, and it was amazing. I mean, people were falling all over each other to talk to the artists, and you know, people were basically like doing cartwheels. This is incredible. I love it. And I thought I had nailed it. You know, whatever tweaks I had made to the formula were totally spot on. And then we went to San Francisco in the Mission, and people had their earbuds in and their heads down, like, don't ask me for money. Don't ask me for money. And then I realized, like, maybe that's just LA. People are just so happy there. So really every city was different and awesome, just really different in terms of the way that the people interacted and the connections that people made. Most of the people that stopped were really interested in talking to each of the five artists and really making an informed decision on which piece they wanted to have. And a lot of the artists received follow-up emails and phone calls and iPhone pictures of the photograph hanging in their house. And the idea was really to hopefully give someone an experience that would be transformative in some way, so that they have this piece now hanging on their wall, and when they're looking at that, and when they're looking at the big gallery wrap tulip they bought at IKEA, this mass-produced thing, that they feel differently.
Yeah.
That they don't have a connection to the IKEA piece. And the other one, they can think about the full experience and meeting the artist and knowing that they are this person's collector and helping them, you know, support them in their career. And
also maybe knowing that that piece had meaning specifically
exactly,
to the artist.
Exactly. To the artist and to them, that yeah. they somehow connected to it. And so hopefully the next time they want to buy something, that they would seek out other arts experiences in their community, or that they would be more motivated to support artists and buy original art.
So interesting. I think when you were talking about the different cities and the different personalities, I think that kind of brings us right back to the whole point of attunement, because you had to sort of be in attunement with each city that you went to and sort of change your tack.
Yes. And it was very, very different city to city.
Which is really interesting. And I think really interesting to bring it back to a business perspective, in that, you know, if you have your business, as you said, when your gallery originally opened, you were on the West Side, you moved to Virginia Highlands because that had a different feel.
Sure.
And not that there's anything wrong with the West Side, by the way, but,
it's lovely.
But that any company also, as they grow and they grow into a new part of town or a new city altogether or a new country, has to really be in attunement with the
no,
people that are there.
I think that's really interesting. When I had my, so again, I mean, this has all been a learning experience for me. And I thought if I was on the West Side in the Arts District, which actually doesn't exist anymore, but at the time
sad.
It did. I know,
yeah.
I know. It's still great over there. in this beautiful big gallery space. And what I realized is we still only had people come in during openings. That's just the culture in Atlanta. And there's nothing wrong with that. It's that I needed to adapt. And I also, like I said, I'm really trying to cultivate new audiences. I spend a lot of time making personal relationships with people and bringing them to the point of feeling confident and about wanting to move forward and buy art and own art. And that's really exciting for them and for the artist. But I started getting feedback like, oh, I'm sorry I didn't make it to the opening. I'll come to the next one. And in my head, I'm thinking, well, it's different art. But I'm in their head, there was something about having exhibitions in the same space with the same white walls every time that was starting to feel really static and stale. And so I felt that given my audience, that I needed to adapt. And so I started doing exhibitions in unique spaces that fit the work. We did a hip hop photography show in a hip hop club with a DJ and break dancers. It was totally insane. we did this bird show at a loft space with a gazillion origami birds and white lights, and it created a full experience. And I read a lot of arts engagement studies, and really an aesthetic experience where to attract a new person, it needs to really hit them on a lot of different levels. They need an opportunity to be able to intellectually engage with something and have an experience that hits them on a lot of different sensory levels.
Two things. One, I want to talk a little bit more about just, again, from a business perspective, you are saying some things that I think a lot that you apparently just figured out intuitively yourself as a business person trying to survive.
Sure.
That I need to be open-minded. I need to listen to what my customers are saying. I need to make changes based on what they're saying, and that I can be sort of ultimately successful if I listen,
right,
instead of just waiting in my gallery every day for people to walk through the door.
Right.
Which I think is a lesson that can really go across all kinds of industries. It's not true just for gallery owners, obviously. I had to do the same thing when I had a bookstore. People didn't just come in. I had to create events, and then people right. started coming in, right? Right? But also, on a completely separate, just on an art note and on a personal level, I know for me, somewhere early in my 20s, I think it was now my ex-sister-in-law who was an attorney and had a decent amount of money and had some beautiful pieces in her house, said something to me like, you should definitely buy original art. It doesn't matter what it costs. It doesn't matter who did it.
Absolutely.
But you should buy original art, not posters and prints and stuff like that. And I think she shamed me in some way.
And whatever it takes.
Whatever it takes. But the thing is, it stuck in my head that it didn't matter if it was worth anything in the market. It was really if I liked it and it was original. And I have enough of a desire to sort of be original that I didn't want to have the same print in my house that's hanging in everybody else's
Absolutely.
House from IKEA or wherever. Sorry, IKEA.
really, we just got a table from you.
Yeah, we love your furniture. Uh-huh. yeah, but I think I have a lot of friends who didn't get that message from their very wealthy sister-in-law when they
right.
were in their 20s. And they'll ask me stuff about decorating, you know, will you come with me to shop for stuff? And then they'll be picking out a picture at a Pier 1 or an IKEA or something. Mm-hmm. And I'm sort of internally cringing and not knowing how to say, you know, original art would be better. Do you have any suggestions for sort of how to talk to people?
I have a lot of suggestions.
Let's hear some.
I mean, so I think about this, what are these barriers to entry or perceptual barriers to entry? And I think one is that a lot of people think that original art is out of their price range, which again, like you said, doesn't have to be true. I mean, it can cost $5. It can be something that it can be anything. So, but the other too is that I think that people aren't confident in their tastes and they don't feel like they know enough about art to make an informed decision. It's like, I don't have an art history degree. I don't have any context to put this piece in. I mean, I like it, but what if it's not good? What if I hang it up and I'm embarrassing myself? and so I do really think that lends itself to people wanting to connect with gallery owners or curators or to be able to have someone to lead them. And in this case, your friends have chosen you to be their guide,
right.
their
by,
art guide.
By asking that question, right. But then I chicken out because I don't want to offend them and be like, well, all those prints you have in your house aren't really ugly and you should come with me to Jennifer's gallery, you know.
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, I think that...
that'd be okay with you.
Right, right. I think that it's also, like you said, that you have a desire to be original. And I think that, and you also said earlier that people are, the business world is shifting. People are shifting in terms of what they want and what they're looking for. And I think that is also applies to people in their personal life. And I think that culturally we're in our prime and we're curious and we're seekers and we care about the things in our world and we want to know where our food comes from and how our coffee's roasted. And people have said to me, oh, you opened a gallery in like the worst economy. And to me, the people that I'm talking about, which is a lot of us, it's not so much about that. It's just we don't have an art budget set aside. I mean, we're fine spending $5 to $10 a day on a latte or whatever it is. David's drinking the green tea latte chai.
Yeah, that was $17.
with soy milk.
Right.
That's right.
And a lot of, I mean, you can buy an original, really limited photograph from a photographer who's really going somewhere from me for $500. And I'm not saying that that's nothing, but I'm also saying that that's a night out in a pair of jeans for a lot of people. Then we do that without batting an eye. And I do it too. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't. I'm saying that art is something that can really add a lot of value if it's something that really speaks to you and that you can connect with, and it's something that you'll have forever. And so it's just a matter of putting, that was this whole crusade for art, crusade for collecting. It was about making art cool, about putting it in the same category as coffee and farm to table and wine and the things that we're interested in kind of diving in and learning about. And I think that if the impulse to drive around the country came from, if I could stand at the register of every IKEA when someone came up with the big tulip and say, that is lovely and matches your throw pillows, but here's an original piece of art that also matches your throw pillows, and here is the artist, and let him tell you about the piece, and now what do you think? You know, where it's, I feel that most people that I know, or that we all know, would rather, if, you know, apples to apples, choose the original. They would want to be one of 5 or 10 people to ever own this piece, that they could literally hand their money directly to the artist,
yeah,
than have something that 5,000 people had over their couch.
Yeah. I also think it's interesting that the money issue comes up so much, because you're right, we will spend money on certain things without blinking an eye.
Absolutely.
And I have to tell you that the first piece of original art I ever bought, I still have, and that was probably 20 something years ago, and it's huge. And the reason I bought it was because it was $400.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it was a little bit more at the, I mean, a little bit less at the time,
right,
than it is now, but still, $400 was a big part of my budget at the time. But one of the reasons I liked it so much was because it was really big,
right,
and it was $400.
Right.
And I liked it. And the truth is, I still like it. And I think it's also an interesting point that the art does not have to match your throw pillows. Like, it can just be something you like, and then it will go.
Right.
Another piece of wisdom from my ex-sister-in-law, by the way.
And I think, too, it's not a, it does, it, you can have this forever and love it forever. But you know what? If you don't, that's okay,
that's
too.
Okay too.
I mean, my husband and I first bought this big painting for $400 from, do you remember that Cafe Two to Tango restaurant in Buckhead?
They
art everywhere.
Yep.
And I mean, we hemmed and hawed and we're like, we'll just eat ramen noodles to be able to pay for it. And it's this paint oil painting of irises, and it's lovely. But for years, it was over our mantle. It was our most prized possession. Now it's in my kids' playroom. Like, it could get hit with a yogurt drink at any moment, and that would be okay. But that's fine.
Right. That's exactly right. Mine was originally central, and now it's, like, in a hallway, but I still love it.
Yeah.
I don't
love mine, but it's okay.
It's
$400, it amortized over the amount of days I loved it.
Done.
Totally right. Worth it.
Give people contact information for the Crusade for Art, for the gallery.
Sure. The Crusade for Art, the website is Crusade for Art, but spelled out, not the number. And the gallery is JenniferSchwartzGallery.com. I'm very reachable on all types of social media and other and other things. But if you, the Crusade for Art website, CrusadeForArt.com, is really a resource for photographers and would-be collectors and people that that are interested, especially artists, on how to sort of best practices and different creative and innovative ways. I try to highlight a lot of people who are doing things differently and getting exposure for their art, and programs that are easily replicable.
Right.
Yes. Because I think that the more we can share these ideas and spread them, then an artist might read something and say, wow, that's such an interesting way to find new people to appreciate my work. That wouldn't fit for me exactly, but if I tweak it in this way, it could. And so my thought, kind of the centerpiece of Crusade for Art going forward, is that I am working to set up a grant for artists. So a significant financial award for an artist or a group of artists annually who need some financial resources to help create and implement a program to build demand for their work. So the tour could have been a project that may have won the grant, or if an artist comes up with an idea for a website where individual people could interact with the different pieces on it in some way, and they would use that money to get it developed. And cool. I really feel that instead of me spending a year and a half traveling around or, you know, planning, that if we can get our creative force to be brainstorming on this issue, how to get more people involved in art, then we're going a long way to make that happen.
Excellent. And all the information about that also on crusadeforart.org.com.
.com.
Okay. All right, Jeffrey, your turn. Time to attack your work here. All right, so author of two novels now.
Yes.
Breath of God and Jericho Deception. One of the most educated people I've probably ever met. And he just has no response. He's just smiling at me like, well, yeah.
To me, it sounds impressive when you say, you know, Yale, Harvard, Oxford to some people. And to me, I'm the biggest idiot in the world. And if you ask my teenage daughter, you know, there's no credibility whatsoever to any of the degrees.
Yes, well, that is what happens with teenage daughters, I can attest. Okay, so I just finished reading The Jericho Deception late last night. And there was definitely some similarities between The Jericho Deception and The Breath of God. And the main one being that you're clearly very interested in all kind of world religions. And with all your education, sort of how they can live at the same time as science. So talk a little bit about the book, what inspired you to write this one, and just give a little summation of it.
Sure. The Jericho Deception, like my first novel, it's a kind of thriller suspense genre, but it has this strong mystical, spiritual side to it as well. So it's an interesting kind of blending of genres there. And the novel follows a Yale professor, Dr. Ethan Lightman, who is working on what he calls the Logos Machine. And it is a device that can induce mystical spiritual experiences in people through electromagnetic stimulation of the brain. And it's actually based on some real technology. And then there's a murder in his Yale lab, and all of a sudden his life starts falling apart. He realizes that his project could be linked to certain CIA undercover activities. He and a grad student get whisked off to the desert in Egypt, where there's a secret CIA facility with mind control experiments and stuff going on. And so it's this kind of fun blend of technology, of spirituality, of world religions, kind of all together, that takes us from the United States all throughout the Middle East as well.
Now, for somebody who has as much education as you do, who probably could do anything they wanted for a living, why novelist?
Well, I actually, since we're on a business radio show right now, I mean, I began my career in business, and I'm still CEO of a real estate company. For me, I was running a large real estate company back in the 90s and the 2000s. It was a family company. And I had achieved a lot of success. I kind of had checked off at a young age all the goals that I thought I'd wanted to do, and was looking around, and it's like, is this bringing me true happiness and true joy? I had the big house, I had fancy cars, at times I was flying on private planes, and buying cool artwork, but I wasn't fulfilled. And I came to realize that there was a difference between success and significance. And for me, I'd achieved those trappings of success, but I was looking for a deeper meaning in my life. I was curious about religion, spirituality. My wife then said, Jeff, you know, you need to start learning how to meditate. I was very much a type A personality, or you're going to have a heart attack before you're 40. So I started a meditation practice. And I had also this strong creative yearning. It was like a calling deep within me that I would try to ignore, and that business at time could satisfy. I was somewhat of a deal junkie. So when I was in a creative process of a deal, that piece of me could be fulfilled. But most of my day wasn't like that. It wasn't the creative rush of a new deal. And so I had a folder in my desk that was called Story Ideas. Because part of me, like a lot of people, I kind of wanted to write that great American novel one day, and having this kind of strong academic background, I'd done all this reading in my past, but I never took that desire seriously. It was always a dream that I was going to do one day. And I would have days at work where I'd be kind of bored sitting around, and all of a sudden an idea for a story would come, and I would jot it down and stick it in my folder in my desk for that one day when I would write the book. And then all of a sudden, as I was sitting there one day, I realized, you know, when does this one day happen? Is it when I retire? Is it when I have enough money? And then, you know, what is enough money? It's like it didn't seem to matter how much I would make and how successful that, you know, the house would get bigger and the cars would get more expensive. There was never really enough. And then I realized one day is always in the future. And it was a simple epiphany about that. And when I had that day, I began writing The Breath of God, my first novel. And that novel took me to India and throughout the Himalayas. And then the research was so fascinating to me. I decided I wanted to explore it more academically. And at that time, I'd done my undergraduate at Yale, then I'd gone to Harvard Law School. This was kind of late 2000s. I ended up selling my real estate business actually twice. I sold it in 2005, and then I started up a new company, and then we sold all of our properties right before the crash in 2008.
Good timing.
So it was good timing then. And ended up taking my family, and we moved to England. I went to Oxford and got a master's in world religions. So the research for The Breath of God, because it had this East and West kind of play of spirituality, all that research, I read over 50 books for it. I decided I wanted to study it more academically. So it took me to England, to Oxford, where I got a master's in world religions, came back, and then started working on the Jericho Deception. While I'm still doing real estate, I still have my real estate company on the side. We're smaller now, very entrepreneurial. But it allows me to kind of fulfill that kind of creative urge that I have. And then to blend, I read so many different things. I read pure thriller, kind of beach type stuff, and then I read very deep, you know, ancient Greek, German philosophy and stuff like that. So it's all over the, and I'll read Plato in the evening and People magazine at lunch.
Nice.
So it's I'm all over the place
Kim
with that
Kardashian
kind of thing.
Yeah, it's Plato.
Exactly. Exactly.
Which one gives you the better life lessons? Oh, probably.
So, you know.
Oh, that's a good question. That's
depending on how you read popular culture.
Exactly. So the Jericho Deception came from a Wired magazine article that my wife had given me to read about this Canadian neuroscientist that had developed what he called the God Helmet. And it used electromagnetic stimulation of the brain based on, there's a medical device called TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation, that they use in a lot of people with severe depression. And literally, it uses magnetic pulses to the sides of the brain, and it can affect what's happening in your brain at that time. And it's a very effective treatment for depression. Well, this Canadian scientist had been studying mystical experiences and came up with a way in which he could tune one of those machines to try to create some kind of a mystical experience in people. And the idea was so fascinating to me about how you could possibly create that experience of God. And then I started thinking about, well, what if how could that be misused? Religion is one of the most powerful experiences that we have. And we see great things that are done in the name of religion, and we see the most horrible atrocities at the same time throughout history have been caused in the name of religion. And the conflict, as you mentioned earlier, kind of this the importance of interreligious, interfaith dialogue is a big theme in both of my novels.
Yes.
Because I see more often than not religions causing conflict within the world. And to me, religion should be a source of unity and of peace, not the opposite of that. And so those are important themes I try to tackle with this. But then I use this kind of device of, what if you had this technology, and how could that be misused to brainwash people throughout the novel?
Well, it's so interesting because we think of science being misused often, right? I mean, we think about, in fact, you give examples specifically in the book of, you know, science where it was originally created for one reason and then, you know, bastardized, if you will, by usually a government, you know, for evil, shall we say. And I'm oversimplifying, but you know what I'm saying. Nuclear bomb, for example. But I think what you're sort of saying is the same is true of religion. In its truest form, it's meant to bring people together and give people hope and, you know, something to answer their questions and give them comfort and all these other things. But it's been misused by people in power often to get people to do things like kill each other and blow each other up and all those wonderful things. So it's kind of interesting because when I first read the premise of the book, I thought, oh, okay, you know, if this machine can give people this sensation of seeing God, then that would sort of disprove that God is real in a way, right? It would just mean, well, I can create that magnetically, so it's like turning on a TV. It's fake. But that is not the point of the book at all.
No, and it raises that. It does raise that question. And my novels, even though they're about spirituality, about religion, I try very hard not to make them preachy.
Yeah.
It's more I try to raise thought-provoking questions and have the reader come to their own conclusions. But some of the neuroscientific research that's been done on the brain is so fascinating to me. So, I mean, I could stick – well, I'm not me because I'm not a neurologist. But if I was a neurosurgeon, you know, I could implant an electrode in your brain – and in certain areas, and if I could stimulate it, you know, all of a sudden you might smell a fruit. You might smell an orange or something like that. You can even taste an orange. You can give people an orgasm from just an electromagnetic stimulation in a certain part of the brain.
I would like to have that machine. Yeah. Just saying.
You might never turn it off.
That helmet has a different name.
Yeah.
Oh, good point.
So, but does that mean because we can stimulate, there's an area of the brain in which causes you to see the color red or to smell an orange, does that mean that orange and red are not real?
Right.
No, I mean, we've evolved certain neurological mechanisms that allow us to experience the world around us.
Right.
So should religious experience be any different than that? You know, because, in fact, we might even ask, why is it that humanity has evolved the mechanism to have these religious experiences that are universal across cultures? And it's the universality of religious experience. It's one of the fascinating things for me. There was a Harvard psychologist by the name of William James a century ago that really studied this. It's one of the pioneers of how he looked across cultures and across people and saw that one constant thing, religious doctrines can be very different. But there's a core kind of religious experience of that ability to kind of touch the other, to move past our everyday reality and experience an ultimate reality. And it can be experienced in different ways, but there's this sense of kind of unity, of peace from people that have had these kind of mystical experiences that you find across cultures. So we might ask, why has the human mind evolved that ability? And one answer, I mean, there may be evolutionary answers that it helps group cohesion and survivability, but I think a legitimate answer is just as we've evolved the ability to taste an apple or to see the color red, we've evolved the ability to touch this kind of other dimension to our lives because that is real too.
Yeah, yeah. We could probably talk about, I could probably have you on for a whole hour by yourself just to talk about like some of the details in the book. Some of the things the different people see in their visions are pretty fascinating. And it's, I think, pretty clear as a reader. First of all, I just want to say for the readers who have not read Jeffrey Small yet, you need to. If you're a Dan Brown fan, I mean, he definitely is a page turner. I mean, I was just whoosh, right through it. But also, you definitely are asking rather than telling, I think, in the book, which I think is good because nobody really wants to be preached to. Well, lots of people want to be preached to, but not in their fiction generally.
Right.
But I think one of the reasons before we got on the air, I asked Jeffrey Small to visit us at book club. And the reason I did is because I feel like there's so much to dig into in the book in terms of the different religions relating to one another, the way different people experience the machine and what it did to them. They didn't all see the same God, quote unquote.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So a lot to dig into. And I would love to have you at book club and, you know, back on the show too. But
definitely.
In the meantime, let's give people information, how to find the book, how to find you, all of that.
Yeah. So you can find me on my website, jeffreysmall.com. The book, the newest one, The Jericho Deception or The Breath of God, they're both available in bookstores. So Barnes & Noble, your independent bookstores, obviously online. I know you bought it on the Kindle.
I did.
And we do more and more of the sales are ebooks now. It's almost hard to find a bookstore today.
I hate to admit it. I mean, anybody who listens to the show knows that I used to own an independent bookstore, and I love books, and I love the fact that they're on paper on the one hand. On the other hand, I've reached a certain age where I have to hold the book fairly far away from my head in order to read it. So I've just changed the size of the font in my Kindle.
And I'm the same way. And I have to say, as an author, you would think that I would only buy paper books, but I don't. I read most of the books now on my iPad.
So. And I'm glad you actually mentioned that, because we're going to turn to David here next. But you know, most of the authors who I meet don't actually, though they may like paper, they just want you to read them.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter.
That's all I care about.
It doesn't matter what format it's in.
Any way you want it, just...
Yeah, audio, paper, ebook. As long as you're consuming the material, you're keeping the authors in business, and that's...
Exactly.
That's all that matters. Well, it's not all that matters, but it matters. All right, I want to turn to you, David, because Jeffrey made some pretty interesting points, both about his own career, but both Jennifer and Jeffrey have careers with meaning, certainly.
Fascinating points.
Yeah. But so talk a little bit about what you're up to these days.
Yeah, well, first I'd like to react, I think, to what they have going on.
Please.
Because Jennifer made me think about the world of creativity and barriers to creativity and how that applies to a business context.
Yeah.
And, you know, she's trying to find these curators for these artists, you know, collectors for these artists. And I'm wondering if there's a possibility to combine that with some of what business needs. And business is starved for creativity. In a lot of cases. And it just made me think about how these companies with multi-floor offices in buildings or even larger need to decorate these spaces. You know, what if they became a patron for an artist, and then that artist could also be sort of a creative consultant for these businesses? I mean, artists are artists because they see reality in a different way and have a way of presenting it in such that it gives people an emotional, you know, resonance. And I think a lot of business could use some more artist input to have much more creative solutions. So just an idea that I had, you know, listening to you.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be cool in a way to have an artist who's sort of undiscovered have their work in a company in the hallways, come there and do a lunch and learn? I mean, wouldn't you rather go to a lunch and learn with an artist than
Absolutely.
With some boring person talking about, like, you know, HR practices?
Absolutely.
Just saying.
There's an article recently about, is an MFA the new MBA, that a lot of companies are wanting to hire artists because they're able to be more flexible. They're used to kind of working really hard and scrapping it together. And they think in a little bit of a unique way.
I think one of the, and I'm going to let you react to Jeffrey next,
sure.
But I think one of the interesting sort of things that is common in what they both spoke about is that they're asking people to think in a new way. They're asking people to open their minds, whether it's to art or to, you know, meaning, religion, science, whatever the case may be. And I think from my perspective and all the reading I've been doing lately, we need to be doing that in business as well.
Absolutely.
Thinking in a new way. And all the books that you read out there agree. They all say, let's think in a new way.
Yeah.
But corporate America hasn't quite embraced that yet.
Yeah. And there's a lot of what Jeffrey talks about that can help corporate America embrace that. Looking into a deeper side of ourselves that isn't necessarily taught in a traditional, you know, management doctrine. The other thing it made me think about is IKEA has it all wrong. They shouldn't be selling these prefab prints. They should be selling put together artwork, just like their furniture. Like, imagine if IKEA sold artwork you assembled at home and it was different for everyone. Then
that was I got chills. What a great idea.
They solved the unique thing.
That's a great idea.
But Jeffrey, I was reading his blog, and he has this sort of mantra at the top that's, you know, don't believe, question, think, experience. And that is fundamental to the business world as well. That's how we can start changing our minds, because there's many of us running around there as executives and leaders in companies, and we're believing what we've been taught, and we're believing that's what has worked in the past, you know, may continue to work. But clearly, the current state of business hasn't provided an adequate solution for almost anyone, you know, not individuals. I mean, 70% of the American workforce is either unengaged in their jobs or actively disengaged.
Yeah.
I mean, there's, you know, certainly you can make the case that business hasn't been good for the environment. You know, what Jeffrey, amazingly successful man, but at the top of his career, he realized it wasn't satisfying to him.
Right.
This path he had taken, you know, to have, as he put it, the trappings of success. So who's it really serving the way that we're currently running things in the business world? And so there's so much opportunity to to do things differently when we look at things from a different perspective.
I think there's a little bit of a new order. It'll be really interesting to see what happens as the so-called millennials kind of move more into the workplace, because we raised them, and I'm pointing at Jeffrey and I because our kids are similar age, and we came up kind of, I think we're around the same age. I might be aging him, sorry, but we came up kind of in the 80s, you know, yeah. when it was all about Wall Street success, more money, climb the ladder, you know, corporate. And so we, I think probably both, and I think a lot of people at our age, some people just were successful at that and are okay with that and so be it. But I think a lot of us kind of got to a point where we said, yeah, no, this is not it. I got here. I got the big house. I got the car. I have the big title. I'm not happy. Now I need to go pursue what makes me happy. So we raised our kids to pursue what makes them happy. So it'll be really interesting as these kids who have learned from us not to go after necessarily just dollars, but to go after things that fulfill them, not just make them happy, but fulfill them, if they start to change the landscape. I hope they do.
Absolutely. I mean, you see millennials going into the workforce, and it causes amazing consternation among some executives and leaders who don't know how to who think that millennials just don't want to work, you know, and they have and millennials have this sort of sense of entitlement. I mean, I hear blanket statements like that all the time, but they want to be treated like VPs as soon as they walk through the door. The difference is that they approach work from the perspective of fulfillment and not from the perspective of what are my marching orders.
Right.
And so it's not that they don't want to work. Engaged millennials are some of the hardest working, most ingenious people out there that I've met in the workforce. The trick is knowing how to engage them. And you can't engage them from a traditional approach. You have to go deeper into your own values and your company's values and really try to ask yourself why of what you're doing. You know, so many companies are totally focused on how they're going to do their marketing, how they're going to create their products and develop their supply chain. But the why do you exist is a much more important question that can engage people in a way that will just explode productivity and creativity.
Which I think also goes back to attunement. I mean,
exactly.
It's all about listening, you know, listening to what your customers tell you and maybe deciding to have more events outside of your gallery, you know, listening to your kids, listening to your coworkers, listening to your customers, listening to your readers, you know. I mean, I think that's something that we have to learn because most of us are not taught to listen.
Hmm.
So tell me a little bit from a business standpoint, what you're doing project wise.
Yeah. So Blue Earth Network is a company that it works with change makers who are in large organizations or small organizations that really want to take their true purpose and make it a reality in the business world. So we partner with them to unearth their deepest intent for what change they want to bring to the world, and we help them make that real.
Wow.
And we work with them from the very beginning in identifying passions, understanding some of the social problems that they're interested in, understanding their current business setup, whether they're a large company or they're just a startup, and understanding how we can create new business ideas and business models that allow them to activate their true purpose through business. And when you do that in companies that have done that, and we have this whole process, we, you know, take people through companies that use this have much more loyal fans. They have much higher return on the assets. They have much more engaged employees, and they have a much more focused direction that allows them, in somewhat of a paradox, to be more creative because their focus isn't on the product they're making. Their focus is on their true purpose and realizing that true purpose. And when you have that as your lens, you have your creativity for solving that true purpose, it just bubbles up ideas.
So can you give me an example of a company, like what they sell and then what their true purpose is? Without giving away somebody's trade secrets, I guess.
No, sure. Well, you know, one company we like to use as an example is Apple. You know, they haven't necessarily consciously gone through this process, but when you look at some of the things they do, for example, you read about Steve Jobs and the approach he took to business. He was solving a problem of creativity and productivity. He didn't see himself as making a technology. He wasn't a computer company. He was someone who's providing a solution that allowed someone to be creative and productive, because he believed on the fundamental level that we're all creative. And so when that was his lens, I mean, that allowed them, supposedly a computer company, to create, you know, the whole music ecosystem that dominated the music landscape for years.
Right.
You know, and compare that to like a traditional computer company and who are only focused on their product. And look what happens in the marketplace. You know, their Apple has never had to discount.
Right.
They've never had the same amount of competition. They have amazingly loyal following. I mean, right. their earnings per share better than all the other computer companies. You know why? They took a different approach based on a deeper true purpose. It wasn't about their products. It was about what are we really bringing to the world for other people. You know.
Yeah.
And you compare that to, I mean, look at, you buy a PC laptop. There are like 700 stickers on it about, you know, what's inside and how good the technology is. And
yeah.
They think that that's going to give someone confidence that there's really good hardware in there. But someone looks at that and it just looks, first of all, it looks ugly.
Yeah.
And secondly, it looks, honestly, a lot of people react, that's intimidating.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what any of that stuff is.
Right. And they just had a few more acronyms.
Right.
And then the SDDKRP.
Yeah. Yeah. Know. You know, X, yeah, 4.
Right.
And then look at Apple's computers. I mean, there's not, you know, it's like a smooth, sleek. It just, you want to engage with it and touch it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, everything from the way he ran his company to the end design of the product had to do with making creativity accessible on an emotional level.
Right.
So this is something really important about what we do, is that a lot of times the emotional engagement that a company has with their constituents is not even addressed at all. We'll go into companies and we'll say, what are the emotions you want your customer to have when they interact with your product? What do you want them to feel inside? And, well, we want them to feel like it's a good deal.
Right.
Well, that's not a feeling. Sorry. You're still operating in the rational area. You know, let's go deeper. What do you want them to feel? I guess happy that they got a good deal.
Yeah.
You know, it's really hard to walk them through. But when you get to that level, no, we want them to feel confidence, or we want them to feel connection with someone else. And you operate at this, because believe it or not, that's how we make decisions.
Yeah.
We're not making decisions in our rational brain most of the time.
No.
Most of the time we have an emotional reaction and we make a decision, and then our rational brain catches up to our emotional system, which operates
a
much
gut
faster.
Feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A gut feeling, or even, you know, even just a first impression.
Right.
And then most of the time what your rational brain is doing is finding reasons why that's true.
Well, it's even that way when you think about it for pricing. You know, like you want to buy a product and you have an idea in your mind of what that should cost. There's no science behind that. You just have an idea that peanut butter should not be $7. It should be $3 and change. So if you get to the grocery store and it's $7, you're deeply offended.
Yeah.
You know, if it's 50 cents, you think something's wrong with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't, but it's completely an emotional response. There's no science behind that. You don't know. I have no idea what it costs to harvest peanuts.
Yeah. No, but there is a lot of science behind the idea that emotional response is the majority of our decision making.
Absolutely.
And if businesses use that to their advantage, and they can really make some serious strides in how they operate and what they create in a way that engages customers far beyond what they're currently doing. And that's what we try to do.
So before we run out of time, I want to make sure you give contact information if people need some consulting and need to find their purpose. How do they get a hold of you?
Yeah, sure. So blueearthnetwork.com is a place to start. They can email me at david@blueearthnetwork.com. The information about how we approach our website is pretty comprehensive. So they can contact me there and be happy to talk to them about how they want to change, you know, what they're doing.
All right, we have a few more minutes left, and I want to kind of get the group involved in a conversation to talk a little bit about, just to jump off from where you were, about finding that meaningful work, finding purpose at work. Because I know a lot of people, I'm sure you all, first of all, I think all the people in this room are doing something that they find meaning in, right? And that's a beautiful thing, because I know a lot of people who go to work to make money and come home, and they have no purpose in terms of their job. They're just doing a job to make money. And I've talked to some of my friends who are probably in my age range again, who say they're at a place where they would like to find that purpose and that meaning. They're not satisfied, right? They are looking for more, but they have no idea where to start. They have no idea what they really want. How do you find that if it's not something that's already clear to you?
Yeah, we're not taught to be very good self-examiners, you know, and people I talk to, they say, I want to find a fit for my skills. You know, what's the next move you want to make in your career? I want to find a fit for my skills.
Well, right.
Why? Well, because that's what I'd be good at. But is that going to satisfy you? what is it, you know, Jeff's question about success is really important. What does success mean to you is a unique answer to every single person. And if you can really get down to the bottom of that question, you can, that's a great place to start with how do I really find out what I want to do?
Yeah.
Because you might discover that really at the bottom, what success means for me is that each day I'm helping at least one person.
Right.
If I did that each day, I'd be happy. And then imagine how all your decisions would be different if that's really how the answer is going to be different for each person.
Sure.
Yeah, and I agree with that. I think your example is great of, you know, is success, could it be helping one person? I mean, for me personally, what I saw the difference between success and significance, success was focused on me. And it was, you know, how many things could I, how much money could I make? How important was I? How many newspaper articles could I be in about real estate? Things like that. That ultimately was not fulfilling when it was just about the things that were bringing me glory. For me, significance was that interconnection with others. And that's something that I felt like I can do with my writing of how can I touch people and reach out. And so your example of, you know, maybe is it helping one other person in that day? And so I think that so much of it is about finding these connections. I went through a whole process of trying to figure out what it was I wanted to do. And there are consultants, coaches that can help people do that. But to me, a lot of it is self-discovery. It's trying to understand who you are as a person. And I went and did certain exercises where I went back through my childhood and wrote down, okay, these were the 10 times I felt most engaged, most connected, where almost I was lost in something. And it could have been an activity, anything, a hobby. And then I started writing down, well, what about those experiences brought me that engagement? You know, and it's those times where you could get lost in what you were doing. And then I started looking at these 10 experiences, and so what was in common? And it was, for me, it was the creative process. It was connecting with others. And so, but without, I think, going through that, I don't know if I ever would have started to write a book.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. It's not just the task or the skill. It's what is it about doing something that is motivating or makes you feel good. So, I mean, but it does take a lot of kind of self-reflection and also being really self-aware. And I do think that can be really hard for people. And it might be making money. Making money at the end of the day is what motivates you. But if it's not, then you have to move beyond. And sometimes I do think, too, that you can also find that satisfaction in things outside of your work life.
True.
So you might have a job that you're good at, that provides for your family, that you enjoy, but the things that fulfill you the most might be the volunteer work you do on the side, or the relationships you have in your life, or they're not,
or the photography,
right,
the art.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's very challenging to make a living as an artist. I mean, as an author, I love this. I reach thousands of people. I don't make my living. I still make my living in business,
yeah,
but it's my passion. And
right.
And I think for many in the artistic world,
absolutely,
that's the reality of
that. For most in the artistic world, that would be the reality of it.
Yeah. I think we could probably talk for days and days and days about this. You know, I also think finding your purpose in your work, if you can, is great. Trial and error. I mean, I know for me, you said, you know, part of it is self-discovery and part of that is trying something and figuring out, I don't really like this. Or trying something and maybe figuring out, well, there are parts of this that really did work for me. Maybe I go to that job every day and I actually hate what I'm doing, but I love the people I work with. And
right,
what about that? Why? What's happening in that group dynamic that really works for me? And on the money piece, before we close out, I'll just say, I've gotten very close, I think, to knowing exactly where I want to be. And there are, you know, I can sort of go number one, this, the job has to have this, number two, it has to have this, number three, this. And one of the things it has to have is pay. You know, I want to get paid for what I do. And,
sure.
You know, if I meet somebody and they offer me some opportunity to do something that sounds really great to me in every other aspect, but there's no pay, you know, no. I'm not in a position where I have a wealthy husband and I can just volunteer my time. That would be great if that were the case, or if I was a lottery winner or whatever. But since that's not the case, being paid is important to me. And also, I think being paid shows that the person values your work. It's the same reason why, you know, you might give away some photography here or there, but ultimately those artists need to get paid for their work.
Absolutely. And that was a big pushback I got about the tour. You're giving away art. How is that valuing art and the artist. And again, that's not something that I advocate every artist do at every stage in their career, or that even people early on who want to participate in this, that they do regularly. But like you said, in some cases it can be beneficial.
Yeah, in some cases it's marketing. You gotta do what you gotta do.
To your point also, there's almost always a way to look at your current situation and find a way to bring more of your own passion into it, whether it is developing a hobby on the side or finding the areas at work that you can say, oh, there's room for me to access a little bit more of my passion here. Yeah. Just as a start to see how that makes you to feel and how that coincides with the business environment can be a great way to access some of that extra creativity.
Yeah. And I think my final thought about all of this is just that if people could be truly engaged at work, that would be so much better for the company's bottom line. So if the company, if the company is in touch with its mission and purpose, and it brings the right people on the bus, my new favorite saying, and they're all engaged and loving what they do, that is going to only improve the bottom line. So with that, we're going to wrap it up. I'm Dana Barrett. This has been Good Morning Atlanta. We will see you next week.